Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
When you're trading options, Fidelity has just what you need, with straightforward but powerful tools to help you select a strategy and execute your ideas. And they offer a wide range of information and insights to help simplify your trading experience. Have a question? Ask it live during their small classes and coaching sessions. Need information? Check out their educational videos, articles, and webinars. See why it's easy to trade options your way at Fidelity. Start now at fidelity.com/options.
Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
Welcome to the On The Tape podcast. I am Dan Nathan, joined by Danny Moses. Guy Dami will be back with us on Monday. I know many of you have been breathless with anticipation for him to get back. But if you are breathless and waiting for some good analysis, our guest today in Guy's seat returns to the pod. It's Cameron Dawson. She is the CIO at New Edge Wealth. Cameron, welcome back to the pod.
Thank you for having me. I think Guy intentionally chose not to be here this week, planned it, knew I was coming, and said, no, I'd rather be
I actually think
away.
We're not doxing him. He's in Ireland.
Yeah.
Let's be
well,
clear.
He's been live tweeting.
Right, his way through Ireland, right? Through his eyes, right? I think I thought he was at Epcot, Ireland, for a while, but then it looks like he's in real
There's
Ireland.
No Ireland at Epcot.
But it took him to leave this continent in order for the market to start doing the things that he's been talking about for a long time.
Well, by the way, Cameron, so Danny says this every time that he goes on a week vacation. He said, get your puts ready. He's like, get everything ready, because it always is calamity when he leaves. Hey, just a little housekeeping right here. Guy and I are going to be down at the FactSet Focus Conference in Miami. That is going to be on April 30th. Through May 2nd. So if you are a FactSet customer or want to be a FactSet customer, check it out. We're going to be doing a lot of stuff on stage there and a lot of fun podcasts and the like here. So that is going to be at the end of this month, the start of next month. So we're excited about that. Cameron, we're going to cover a lot of stuff today. You are a prolific writer and reporter. You had a Monday. Where can people find your Monday report? Do you post it on the internet or something? You do this big, big chart package thing.
Yeah, this is a new publication as of right now. It's been going just to our clients, but we have a sign up on the New Edge Wealth website where you can sign up for the distribution list. So that'll start going out soon. Also write a weekly piece that comes out Saturday morning that's a bit more long form written, which is fun.
Awesome. All right. So you guys go to New Edge Wealth to check that out. We're going to hit some single stock stuff. We're going to talk about rates and what it means for the equity markets. We're going to talk about some sector stuff. We're going to talk about some earnings that have happened and some of the reactions to them in the market. We're going to preview some sectors that Danny's kind of focused on to give us a little bit of a tell as we get deeper into Q2 here. your last time with us, it was mid-February. The title of the pod was The FOMO Market. You had moved late last year into a much more constructive stance on stocks, I think, right? Coming out of, I think a lot of us in the first half of 2023, we're still kind of licking our wounds a little bit from the bear market in 2022. But here we are. At one point, Cameron, the S&P was up 10% not so long ago. We're down almost 5% from those recent highs. Well, let's do a little vibe check here. How you feeling about that? Is some of that FOMO that we saw from, call it mid-December into just a few weeks ago, it feels like it's petering out a little bit.
Yeah, I would call myself an elder emo, which is a genre of music popular in the 2000s. And I can't help but think of the song Welcome to the Black Parade, which is a little bit of what
Manchester
we've been
seeing. Orchestra.
Nope, My Chemical Romance. Oh, but dude, Manchester Orchestra.
Where are you guys?
A great band. Collie Strings, get it? But this idea that we have seen such a low volatility rally coming off of the October lows of 2023, which was supported by a lot of important things that I think we should go down the checklist. The first one is that growth expectations kept rising for underlying GDP. This has been something that we think, looking back, is probably the most important chart that explains the last 18 months, which is that ever since the beginning of 2023, you've seen growth expectations for GDP be revised higher. That's very different than 22. 22 was all about cutting forecasts, people getting more bearish on the economy, not just in the year of 22, but in the out years. But that turned in 23, that provided a lift to risk assets. You add on top of that rising growth forecast, this liquidity boost that we have been seeing in markets. And it's a bit of a nebulous thing. Everybody defines it differently. But this liquidity boost, we can measure it by what the Treasury and what the Fed have been doing, has been supportive for markets. That's typically supportive for valuations, which of course has been the key underlying driver of this bull run. You also still had room on positioning at the end of the year, where positioning was getting into stretch territory, but not quite at extremes. Same with sentiment. Now that of course changed as we move through this year. And as you get into the very late March readings of those things, you see that sentiment got really stretched. Positioning got stretched. If you looked at things like option activity, nobody wanted downside protection. If you looked at allocations to stocks from individual households, they were a percentage point away from their peaks in 2022, early 22, as well as 2018. So all of that was to say that you had run pretty far in positioning and sentiment and valuations, and you needed a catalyst for you to have any kind of market volatility. Those are the kind of things that can persist. And so clearly the catalyst has been this movement higher in yields, which when you run that up against valuations that started the quarter at 21.6 times forward, the highest level since the tech bubble and the COVID policy bubble, that's where you started to have some trouble. That then raises the question of those two other factors, liquidity and growth expectations. If liquidity remains supportive, then this remains a short and shallow digestion. And if growth expectations remain supportive, it remains a short and shallow digestion. It's if growth forecasts start to get cut that we would turn to be much more cautious on risk assets, which would include equity and credit. So that's why we think the most important chart to watch is 2024 and 2025 forecasts for GDP.
I will address you as the winner of the second ever Edward Moses Scholarship Award. And I just want to mention it because today is his birthday. So I wanted to mention that.
Shout out.
So I want to say, so GDP growth is great. It's great for everybody. It's great for people's jobs and so forth. But you got to move that into the stock market itself. And it's not a great thing necessarily when people are looking for an excuse for the Fed to cut rates. So I want to think about higher GDP. How is it translating into earnings? Some have been impacted, you know, GDP being higher in certain components of it. I mean, and what does that do here? Are we on the other side, I hate to say it, other side of Goldilocks, in the sense of people are just begging? The Fed needs some excuse to just indicate, just to be dovish. We are now fully on the other side of this dovishness that we had the last time that you were on. Basically, we are on the other side of that, right? If you want to look at it. So how do you kind of equip GDP is great, want it to stay strong, and stock prices earn where they are? So how do you balance that?
Yeah, I think that it's a matter of, at what point would a higher for longer Fed truly start to bite the economy? And then that's where GDP staying strong today actually is tomorrow's problem. And that's the interesting thing about 2022 is that if you go back, growth forecasts were cut all that year because of the anticipation that, hey, the Fed's cutting, growth is going to slow down. That's how it always happens. It didn't happen that way this time around, though, because you had this dynamic of a massive refinancing in 2020 and 2021, which immunized a lot of very high quality balance sheets to the impact of rate hikes, whether you're looking at households and those people who could get 30-year mortgages, or you're looking at large corporations, those people who could term out their debt at low rates. And that's where those people, as you've seen interest rates go up, they've seen their cash interest earnings go up much more than they have seen their cash interest costs go up. So when you ask the question of when does a tighter Fed actually impact the market, you have to, I think, answer it in a haves and haves not world. The haves go, I don't really care if the Fed stays higher for longer for now, because I'm earning so much of my cash. My balance sheet is immunized versus these high rates. Now, eventually they will care, because what happens to the have-nots is still important, because those are their customers. The have-nots have balance sheets that will have to be refinanced. And we heard a lot of discussion at the end of last year, beginning of this year, this hopefulness that, hey, the Fed's cutting. I have to refinance debt. It's going to make it easier to refinance that debt. And I'm going to be able to breathe a sigh of relief. You saw people rushing into small caps with this notion, Fed pivots, we're going to get lower rates, balance sheet's not as much of a problem. And that led itself into a really great couple of quarters in investment banking activity. You saw some IPO activity, analyst spirits coming back. You saw credit issuance really tick up high in the first quarter of this year. You've seen that in the likes of Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs and their reports. The question is, though, if you don't get those higher or lower interest rates, then all of that hopefulness, does it just poof?
So bring it back again. So growth expectations and bring it back to the market, it really has to be a function of S&P 500 earnings, right? And so how the S&P has been priced, we quote FactSet, we're trading about a little less now than 21 times. That's above the 5- and 10-year average, which are basically 18 and 17% or something like that, respectively. John Butters, our friend over there at FactSet, he writes the Earnings Insight blog. Really interesting data here. Okay, so let's talk about Q1 earnings that are baked in the cake, but Q2 guidance is really going to be what the market trades on right now. Look at this data that he showed us today. He's looking at the top heaviness of the S&P 500. So NVIDIA, Amazon, Meta, Google, and Microsoft combined are projected to report earnings growth of 63.7% in Q1 of 2024. But this is interesting. The blended actuals plus estimates earnings growth rate for the entire S&P 500 is 1.3%. For Q1. Okay, so we know what's going on here. The blended rate for the other 495 is down 5.1%. So higher dollar, higher rates, higher commodity prices is all kind of weighing on the rest of those that are not benefiting from the secular shift of generative AI. Here's the thing that I find fascinating. He flashes forward to Q4. NVIDIA, Amazon, Meta, Google, and Microsoft combined are projected to report earnings growth of about 20% for Q4. So big deceleration. But here's the most important part. The estimated earnings growth rate for the other 495 companies in the S&P 500 is expected to be 17.2% in Q4. So a massive catch up from almost everything else other than the generative AI bubble. Like, you've been doing this a long time, Cameron. We've been doing this an awful long time. The likelihood of that happening, right, is not particularly great. I just don't see it happening. And that is a function of where the S&P is trading right now, those forward expectations.
And isn't it interesting that Q4 is also the hardest comp from last year, right? So it's not as if you can't even justify it by saying, oh, there's really easy comps because earnings were so weak. I would take what you said and add on top of it the 2025 estimates, where you see in order to get to $273, $274 a share, which is where consensus is, you have the market pricing in an acceleration in revenue growth. So even higher revenue growth in 25 than what you're seeing in 24. And you have a jump to a massively new all-time high record margin. So there is an implicit productivity boom that is baked in to the 2025 numbers. And we've been asking the question of, could that happen? I mean, it's been the wrong thing to bet against margins for the S&P 500. The number of papers that I've seen saying, is it peak margin, going all the way back to 2011, 2012? Clearly the answer was no. But one of the things we think is interesting is that when you hit the last peak in margins, which was 2021, that was being driven by the fact that revenues were growing double digits. You had the benefit of high contribution margins or incremental margins. One of the things that you've seen is that margins have fallen, not because the economy has been ultimately weak. It's just because revenue growth has decelerated to more normal trend. If you don't get that big, huge growth and reacceleration in revenue growth, is that margin number possible? So if I'm watching anything other than GDP estimates going into the second half of the year, it's that 2025 earnings number. The market will trade off of that a lot more than it'll trade off of what 3Q earnings will do. That's the key number to watch.
Let's talk about what an actual Fed rate cut actually does, what it really means. To me, it's a kind of a sell in the news once it happens. Walk us through how that mechanism work its way to the consumer and to the investor? And are people overestimating the impact of what that could mean?
I think the most important starting point is there is a psychological impact to it, which is that does one rate cut become the gateway drug to multiple rate cuts? Is it the start of a cutting cycle where the Fed is effectively signaling that it wants to be supportive of markets and the economy? If you go back, there's some great interesting papers coming out of when they started quantitative easing. And there was discussion about when they would end it during the taper. They talked a lot about something called signaling theory, which is that QE was just one step further between the start of rate hikes. So there is some aspect of the expectations channel that this feeds through. So you go back to that IPO activity, you go back to that investment banking activity, there is an aspect of, hey, Fed is a bit more of our friend. We feel a bit more comfortable. Let's make some investments. But then the practical aspect of what you're saying is that there is a hit to those cash interest payments by the Fed cutting interest rates. You'll see money market rates reset lower or even some bank account rates potentially reset lower. That could have an interesting, almost somewhat denting dynamic to some people's spending capability because they will see their cash interest earnings go down. However, you're not necessarily going to see a decrease in the cash interest expense that they have, meaning that you may not see credit card rates reset lower. And you also, and this is probably the most important part, may not see the long end of the yield curve move lower. Because of all the dynamics around treasury funding, it may not happen that as the 2-year effectively is falling, you may not get a concomitant decrease in the 10-year treasury.
Wait. So you got to explain that.
You got to see what you're dealing with here.
You know us now,
yeah,
okay?
Sorry.
Yeah.
You might not get the same kind of decrease in the 10-year treasury.
Thank you. All right, we're back with you. Thank you.
Which, if we think about past rate cutting cycles, typically they happen because the Fed was cutting for a reason that also came along with a flight to safety, which is what caused the long end of the yield curve to fall. So there could be a scenario that if the Fed is tweaking rates lower and tweaking in this mid-cycle adjustment, and you don't see lower long-term interest rates, people see their cash interest income fall, but they're refinancing at longer end rates, whether you're a real estate company or you're a high yield borrower, could remain higher. And so the end result is that that interest rate cut is not going to have the stimulative effect that you would think it would.
So something's changed in the market to me in terms of the sentiment, not just negative, but the companies that are missing now and the companies that are selling off now are painting a picture, some type of mosaic. And it feels like whether it was a lag effect of what the Fed has been doing for years or whether it's just a normal cycle starting to take place, something's different this time because you don't see kind of the buy on the dips of certain names. It's not unhealthy. It's just kind of a natural shift. It just feels. Do you feel that without even looking when you could just add up the retail earnings and consumer related names? It just feels a little bit different in the last 6 weeks.
And the one chart that I keep watching with an eagle eye to get a sense of that has something changed, which is a great Pulp song, is...
We're going to have to Google it.
Yeah.
You're killing us.
But it's fine.
Keep going. I love learning new things.
Yeah, Deep Tracks Britpop is the equal weight chart of discretionary versus staples.
Equal weight chart, discretionary versus staples.
Was that in your chart pack on Monday?
It was.
So go subscribe, people.
Yeah. You obviously didn't look at as deep as you indicated.
Yeah, exactly. Really. Big fan. Big fan.
Yeah, first time, long time. There you go. Okay, fine.
Equal weight discretionary staples, the reason you would equal weight it is to remove the outsized impact of an Amazon or a Tesla, which are part of the discretionary index. So that ratio tells you a few stories. The first one is risk appetite, risk sentiment. The other one is cyclical versus defensive nature of the market. So in a pro-cyclical, pro-growth environment, the cyclical consumer discretionary names typically outperform the defensive consumer staples names. You saw that 2022, that ratio went down. Staples outperformed discretionary because people were afraid of growth. Now, that also coincides with forecast changes to household consumption. So in the chart in the Monday piece, and I'll post it as well, is that you see that when discretionary is outperforming staples, forecasts for household consumption and GDP, so consumer spending, go up. When discretionary underperform staples, you see those forecasts get cut. And the thing that's been interesting over the last couple of weeks is that you've seen that ratio roll over. It's still technically in an uptrend. I'm not calling the end to it yet, but if I'm watching anything every single day, I'm looking at, can it keep that uptrend? Does it stay? Because if it doesn't, that's a sea change for the pro-cyclical, pro-growth environment that we've been in for the last 18 months.
Is that a leading indicator or a lagging indicator in terms of how you're judging that? I'm just curious because—
It leads. It leads revision. You can slice and dice it a whole bunch of different ways, but over the last, since early 2022, late 2021, it's been a fantastic indicator about where household consumption forecasts are going. Remember, that's 70% of GDP. So if you're cutting household consumption forecasts, you're cutting GDP forecasts, which just means that you're going into an environment where people have less appetite for risk.
With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro-contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections' membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. Trading options might be new for you, or maybe you've been doing it for a while. Either way, Fidelity is your go-to source for clear and relevant information about trading options. For example, ask Fidelity professionals questions during their live small classes and coaching sessions and learn more with educational videos, articles, and webinars. Plus, with Fidelity's straightforward tools and technology, you'll find it easier than ever to trade options your way. See what's waiting for you at fidelity.com/options. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
Let's talk about the leadership. From our perspective, you know, semis have clearly been at the center of this generative AI. Obviously, NVIDIA in the last year and a half has gained $2 trillion or so in market cap. And so I think to Danny's point, what feels different right now is like, let's just talk about what we saw this week. Okay, so we saw ASML, which is a chip equipment maker. They're talking up all the opportunities that they have for these new advanced processes to create these generative AI chips. Okay, and ASML was down 8% when they guided, basically down for the current quarter. Their largest customer is Taiwan Semiconductor, 28% of their business. Taiwan Semiconductor on Thursday overnight reports earnings. they looked pretty good. The guidance looked pretty good. It's been a stalwart. It's gained a couple $100 billion in market cap over the last 6 months. They make 90% of the advanced GPUs that are going in to train these large language models. And then if you just look at who their largest customer is of Taiwan Semi, it takes you to Apple, which is 23% of their business. Now, Apple has obviously been a massive underperformer. They're not involved in the generative AI thing. It's down 15% from its recent all-time highs. It's very near its 52-week lows. Okay?
Are those concomitant?
I have no idea still
you're
what that means.
You're missing a T.
Is it decreasing? Is it decreasing?
Concomitant.
All right. No, thank you.
Sorry, no problem.
No, but like I think it's interesting to kind of thread these sorts of needles in a way. Like it feels like whatever that word that you used is like we're seeing a deceleration of stuff. The sort of stuff that was skipping over each other in 2023 that got people really excited. It was dragging a lot of other stuff up with it. So I just worry that if we lose the semis, and let's be clear, NVIDIA is down 15% from its March 8th all-time intraday high. If, you know, the other ones, you know, Intel doesn't matter. AMD is down 30% in a month. Like, think about that, or a little bit more. So if you lose the highest quality ones, that's kind of my point. How are you thinking about semis, the concentration within tech as it relates to semis, and then the interrelatedness of some of these names? Because sooner or later, they're all going to create, in my opinion, a little bit of a snowball effect.
The first observation is just how important semis are for the tech sector. If you look underneath the surface of tech,
Hold on, you semis or trucks. I just want to, whenever I get a chance to correct you, I got to do something.
Yeah.
I've been called out on six things. All right.
Semis, you know what? I just want to say one thing. Yeah. And shout out to Edward Moses, your dad, this day.
That's
and just
nice.
To be really clear, you guys described this on the first time that Cameron came on.
Yep.
Your dad was a professor
at Rollins,
you went to, and you were the award winner of this program because you're an excellent business school.
Top finance student.
Which is really cool. So shout out to that.
All right.
I think your dad would be very disappointed, though, Danny, that you were correcting his winner.
I
just
want
to be really clear.
Fair enough.
But there is a lot of love here for you guys who are not watching and listening, okay?
And if we want to pivot to Packard and Cummins and Navistar,
I know you know the sector. I know you know. You covered industrials, for God's sake.
All right,
go back to the semis.
And I've been to a trucking conference.
Exactly.
It was fun. Right.
Semi versus semis.
Semis, right?
That's
all.
What we're doing.
Sorry.
Here.
Yes. Okay, yeah, so the semis. Very important. Very important for the overall tech sector, which of course then is very important for the market. It's 30% of the market. And if you look, the semiconductors are the only reasons why you have seen the tech sector hold up. Hardware has been very weak. Now, that is predominantly Apple. Software has been very cuspy on breaking down. It's not quite broken down yet on a relative basis, but it's something that we have to watch closely. It looks a little distributive. If software breaks, hardware breaks, and semis are the only ones that you have left, that would raise questions of can tech still continue to be supportive of this market? Now, if I think about specifically the semiconductor cycle, I would note that we still are fairly early days. We are just getting past this inventory destock, the classic cycle. Let's put AI completely to the side. The classic destocking cycle that happens every single cyclical semiconductor cycle, and that if you look at the overall revenues for the SOX, it still is below the prior peak in 2021. It's a growth cyclical, which means that you always, in the last, let's call it 20 years, have seen a higher high in the revenues than the prior cycle. So what I'd say is that we have to see this as a healthy correction in the semiconductors. It's correcting back to trend. But if that starts to break down in a more meaningful way, it would raise questions about the cyclical recovery we're seeing throughout the global economy. What I'd say is that you're seeing enough signs from things like South Korea exports or Japanese machine tool orders that says that after a year of being in decline, that there is some recovery happening. But could that recovery be stinted? Could you not have the kind of robustness that you typically see in an upcycle? Very likely, because what happens outside of AI and semiconductors we have to consider? Autos, PC laptops, industrial.
Well, that was something Taiwan Semi autos were weak, and a lot of, so we've known that PCs and smartphones have been really weak. And I just want to make one last point on the semis is that what's different this time is the China situation. And this might be something that's fairly, you know, permanent, right? So as we're seeing reshoring, I mean, Taiwan Semi just got a huge grant from the U.S. government via the CHIPS Act to build fabs here in the U.S. And so we're trying to kind of diversify away from China. We know that there's been all these bans on advanced chips sold to China. There will be a knock-on effect if you think about it. So earlier, we started this week out, we saw this headline that China smartphone, this is iPhones, were down 10% year over year. There's going to be nationalistic tendencies. We've seen some of their phones jump up the league tables as it relates to China. So to me, this is what could be different about semis. And I think you had that inventory kind of restocking for the hope that we would see some of this. It's not happening right now. And if China is not like an end market that it was, let's say, 4 or 5 years ago pre-COVID, I think that could be a problem for some of these names that are relying on Gen AI.
That's a really fair point. But we do know that there is a technology refresh cycle underway. And the reshoring, though it doubles capacity in certain places, like it adds capacity to the market, eventually that's deflationary. So you keep that in mind, is that, you know, when you increase supply and you hold demand somewhat constant, prices go down. Always remember, the semiconductor industry is the most cyclical industry in the world outside of anything, but, you know, maybe things like turbines and you know, mining equipment. So respect the fact that you will eventually have a down cycle, and that down cycle will typically come because you've added too much capacity and then demand flags a little bit. So what I'd say is that I agree with you that it is different with this backdrop of China. It's not the kind of customer it was in the past. We know that they are a massive customer of a lot of these semiconductor companies. But because of this arms race, you likely still have some juice. I might say very different things if we break through support in these charts in a way that's more meaningful. But for now, this looks like a healthy correction within an uptrend, and based on all the other things that I mentioned before.
So the one thing, we go back and compare this time period, 1999, 2000. It rhymes. It's not the same. And the one thing that is the same, you think about fiber optics and all that stuff, and those stocks led the charge back then and sold off. Similar to now with the AI stocks, the big ones that are leading it, you get kind of the knock-on effects of other companies that say, we have AI, we have this. So, no, and they get bit up because of the momentum. Yeah. Same thing happened in 99, 2000. You know, someone had a dot-com strategy. They would just get their own website. It would change. So I think what Dan's talking about, and I think he's right, is that if you have this precipitous sell-off in these tech names, inevitably, it's not just about them. It's also saying, what do I own? I bought this C-3PO AI thing. What is that thing?
C-3AI.
See, whatever that thing is. Are their earnings really? Are they? So people are just trying to find something that is thematic in nature, but not fundamentally proven. And yes, it is fundamentally going to happen. So I think that's the danger, is the knockdown below that. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I think that we also have to remember that the customers of these big semiconductor companies are a lot of the software companies and communication companies that are cyclical in their own right, right? Meta is 98% advertising and is buying a ton of chips to be AI, but what happens to their investment plans if the U.S. economy were to slow and you were to see a slowdown in advertising spend, for example? And I think that as you're seeing the arms race for people to all project that they are in AI, it's very unlikely it's going to show up in the numbers yet. There's been a lot of people saying, oh, well, look how great productivity has been in the US. This must be AI. No way. Absolutely not. Productivity is better is because you have had an influx of lower wage workers into the economy. So when you look at the aggregate numbers, it looks like we're generating more output with less wages, and the end result is productivity looks great. There's other reasons why productivity has improved, but it's far too soon to see it in the numbers. And it gets back to when you talked about the 1990s period. I think the thing people forget is how much of a CapEx cycle that was, right? Fiber optics, you were actually like laying cable, and that there was a big, huge technology refresh cycle. Maybe that happens in later 24 and 25. You know, Apple's talked about its new AI chip and its computer. Will we all buy new computers because of this chip? maybe. But I do think that the CapEx portion of it is what would be important for it to have a larger impact on the economy.
So shifting gears from semis, actually back to semis in terms of, we saw trucking, J.B. Hunt. So EY from SoFi, Liz Young has talked this week about the three sectors she's identified that can benefit from a sell-off in other sectors that are defensive in nature. Carter Worth's charts, who we just had on here before, are saying the same exact thing. So let's pretend the S&P stays flat, but money just moves around. Right now, I know you have some of this in your charts. Where are we going? Because if the economy does slow, it's not the industrials, in my opinion. You're starting to see. So where is money going to go here?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing on the industrials is that the relative performance has actually held up rather well over the last couple of weeks. Usually in a risk-off environment, these stocks are kind of the first to be punted. There could be a few reasons for that. People saying, oh no, I want to keep my exposure to infrastructure-related stocks, given all of the spending that's happening. Or the fact, I would point out, that you have PMIs starting to bottom have typically been good for industrials. I think one of the things that the way that we think about the industrials, and we've used the phrase before with them, which is that we're here for a good time and not for a long time. The sector doesn't trend. There have been times where it has a year or two of outperformance and then it mean reverts, because relative performance has typically tracked the PMI, which is a mean reverting index. So eventually what will happen is PMIs will get to the 52 to 54 range. Industrials will be trading at very elevated valuations as they are today, and it can't get better than that. You'll put peak on peak and you'll want to move out of the sector. Sure, there's going to be names that will do really well, but we see it more as a short-term burst than anything else. But it is, and it, the charts look fantastic. It's one of the few sectors that hasn't broken below its 50-day moving average relative, holding up quite well. So that speaks to something and is worth, you know, probably, you know, staying long over the next, let's call it 3 to 6 months, barring any change to the PMI backdrop.
Let's go back to yields for a second, because I want to talk about, there was some home builder results over the last week, obviously banks, and maybe we can touch those a little bit. It's interesting to me that we have 4.64 on the 10-year. About a month ago, folks were saying, well, if we get to 4.35, that was a couple months ago, the high, that might not be great for stocks. And then it was 4.5, and now we're hearing kind of 4.7. Home builders have kind of taken it on the chin a little bit here. They've had this tremendous run. If I'm just looking at the XHB, October lows from 70 to 113 or so, you can see that's massive outperformance relative to the S&P, which I think at its highs was up about 30% or so. We talked a little bit about small caps, but how are you thinking about home builders right now?
Yeah, I don't follow the home builders closely on an individual basis. We typically haven't invested in them very much because of the quality screens. They typically don't check a lot of the boxes of them, you know, given the cyclical nature. But clearly there's that benefit of if mortgage rates stay higher for longer, you're going to have that continuation of people being locked into existing homes and the need for new homes. There was an interesting start of the year, I think, for home builders, where they had a moment where they beat and raised, and some of the stocks really went down hard. I think it was D.R. Horton that was one of those. And sort of that moment to watch going for other names as well, as when you think about when you have that moment where stocks stop going up on good news, typically is a sign that a sea change is upon us. You know, a beat and raise that gets a negative reaction tells you that something has changed, just like a miss and cut in the stock soars tells you that.
Well, and that's great that you brought that up. I mean, the stock was down nearly 10% in January when it reported its Q4, Danny. And so talk to me a little bit, because the stock gapped up today after its earnings, but it's given it all back. And it's really gone sideways for 3 months or so. So it's grinded as the 10-year has gone from like 4.15 to 4.65.
These companies have done a really good job on their balance sheets. They took advantage of the secular change post-COVID and moving out of the cities and so forth. And there was a shortage of new homes that were kind of out there. So we've seen the data on the macro of housing start to come down. The companies are still performing. The stock trades at north of 2x book value, DHI. That historically, it's a builder. Let's be very clear, right? We're putting AI windows in. Okay, maybe they get a bump for that, but I'm joking.
You remember the Disney Channel movie? It was called Smart House, I think. It was amazing. A little after your time, but
yeah, another
my
thing.
Time.
That's seven things now that I don't know that you've said so far. I'm keeping account. All right. So with that, in general, they are cyclicals. Again, just like the semis to a degree. And they have experienced a similar thing, a secular change, but then it becomes so you can hide in them. They beat their earnings. They didn't really guide up much for the rest of the fiscal year, which is why I think Dan, it's pulled in here. And they know that the new orders probably eventually will kind of come in. But What's really interesting is that the problem this cycle around is not residential building. It's on the commercial side. And so when you start to compare where the leverage sits, it doesn't sit on the builder's balance sheet. It doesn't necessarily sit on the consumer's balance sheet. It's sitting in commercial real estate, right? And obviously on the Fed's balance sheet. And that's where the problems lie. And so I know we're going to get into banking here, but when you shift that narrative over, right, what's similar, what's different, there'll never be anything like GFC. I hope not in, you know, my lifetime. But that being said, you got to find where these problems are sitting. And I think that's what we've seen. If you're coming out of the regional banks, you say, okay, maybe I can go into housing. Let's shift to the regional banks here if we can. Your thoughts there. We can get into the big money centers who most have reported at this point. Just talk there. What are you seeing in that sector in general?
Well, the biggest question for us on the commercial real estate side is that if it continues to be this death by a thousand cuts, extend and pretend kind of environment, which has not been a dent to earnings, and you can see even in the delinquency rates, charge-offs, it's not a big uptick even in commercial real estate lending. And very fascinating, remember that sluice survey that we were all watching very closely during the regional banking issues of last year? Lending standards have stopped getting worse, even for commercial real estate. So that sluice survey is rolled over. It doesn't mean that they're easing, but they're not getting any worse, which tells you that you're not seeing this sort of cascade yet. Now, there still is $1.5 trillion of debt that has to be refinanced. The majority of that sits on these smaller regional bank balance sheets. And so what we don't know at this point, and maybe this is a great question for you, Danny, which is that what could cause it to all go burst at once versus it to be a trickle? If it's a trickle, then it doesn't have the same kind of knock-on effect where you get counterparty risk all of a sudden and people stop dealing with each other because we don't know where the risk lies. That's the bigger problem. But I don't know what the catalyst would be for it all to come to a head at one moment versus this extend and pretend.
I think that the Fed is now aware of the issue, right? They got punched in the face. CIVB wasn't about commercial real estate. It was about the move in rates, but then they became just aware of everything. And they've quietly been reaching out to several banks, I think, and doing a much better job from a supervisory perspective. That being said, what's different this time is I believe that investors believe that if there are issues at these banks, and let me just be very clear why you're not seeing that uptick, is because a lot of these loans are being modified or extended another year. They have the ability for 1 or 2 years to kind of do that and kind of push it. So that's one thing. That the big banks, and which is why they act like utilities, almost government vehicles, will be there to bail out. So we had this 3 or 4 banks, oh God, you know, came back. We started a BTFD program. We did all this stuff, open the window, this, that, and the other. So the belief is that whether it's real or not, that there's enough resources available in the private and in the public markets that can protect us. And it might be true. So the answer to that, let's go to the large cap banks, because those are really interesting. They're utility stocks to me for the most part. They're regulated. They're well capitalized. They're not experiencing loan growth because private credit. And by the way, the other thing I would add, your comment on commercial real estate, whereas the rest of it is sitting in private equity. To a degree, we've seen it at Blackstone, it's there. So talk about those big banks. Is there anything to do? You can feel safe owning them. What are your thoughts there?
I think that Jamie Dimon's comments from last week were really interesting because he sounded a bit more risk off than I think some of the other banking heads. Now, they've been sounding that way for quite some time. You know, you've had Bob Michael last year was talking about there being a lot of credit stress that could open the door up for 3% on the 10-year because of a risk off kind of move and a flight to safety. Now, we haven't seen the weakness show up yet. And quite paradoxically, you saw a reserve release from JP Morgan, meaning that they didn't reserve more for credit issues in the last quarter. But everybody keeps talking about, and you heard this from Bank of America as well, this normalization of spending and activity. And the biggest question that we've been asking has been, does normalization turn into outright weakness? Normalization is credit balances, the percentage of disposable income going back up to the pre-pandemic levels. It's charge-offs going up, but not at GFC kinds of highs, but going up. It's the moderation in the spending growth that you're seeing. But as you moderate, do you stop at trend or do you go below trend? We don't know yet because we're still in this moderating type of environment. So if the big banks, they're not sounding the alarm saying that we're seeing something awful, but I don't think that we can ignore what's going on with delinquency delinquencies. I don't think we can ignore what's going on with credit card balances, because if you think about if you see a little wobble in the incomes, all of a sudden those lending ratios start to look really ugly. On private credit, we've taken the stance of one where you have to be incredibly selective, because you're fundamentally lending with little transparency as an investor to lower quality borrowers that can't get access to bank funding, that had gotten access to bank funding in the past. But of course, there's been a pullback and regulatory changes, capital ratios, et cetera. Banks are now wanting back in. But what we're hearing is that as the banks have gotten back in, as all of these private credit funds have been raising capital, you've seen this chase to allocate that capital. And the end result has been is that you've seen the spreads that you're getting on those loans come in. And they're coming in order to not give up on the covenants, but those are the next to go. And so we think that that's actually very late cycle type of behavior where you're extending loans. People are reaching for yield in ways that you would think with cash yields being so high, you wouldn't want to, but maybe that's just the inertia muscle memory of the last 10 years.
You just nailed it. So both sides should be selective. The investor that's putting money investing in private credit and the private credit allocators themselves. And I don't think either is necessarily happening because it's a long duration kind of asset. It's like, all right, looks good. I'm good for a couple of years. But you're right. I think it's extended this cycle to a degree. But you make a great point on the banks, because as the revenue slows and the top line slows, the ratios, even if there's not a huge uptick, will start to look bad. And we've had this opening of IPOs. M&A has happened. It's great. It's healthy. If that starts to slow down also, then I think there's a reason to kind of run a little bit from these banks.
And I think that's actually that Chicken Little moment of this cycle, which is that, you know, Chicken Little, sky is falling all through 2023. We're having a recession. And then all of a sudden—
Who would say something like that? Who in the world?
No, nobody would. Yeah, no, yeah. No, not smart people, no, of course. No. But then you have this moment where nobody believes the recession call anymore and says, no, it can't happen. It's the roaring 2020s and that we're going to keep on keeping on, and forgetting the fact that the Fed has significantly raised the interest rate. Eventually, that will have an impact on the economy. It's just taking longer. Our view has been it's even longer, even more variable lag after 10 plus years of quantitative easing that dulled the economy's sensitivity to short-term interest rates. That's why, and this has a currency implication, that's why Europe is still talking about rate cuts in June. It's because they borrow short. They have so much more of a bank loan exposure. Their mortgages reset every 5 years. They feel the pain of interest rates. And so if we're thinking about the dollar in all of this, if the Fed has to stay higher incrementally than other central banks, you'll be prepared for a stronger dollar. But the converse of that is that strong dollar is typically not associated with a high inflation type of environment. Usually it weighs on commodity prices. It's not this time around. Look at what copper's doing. I'm not sure where that's coming from in a strong dollar environment other than that pro-cyclical kind of flavor that we're starting to see. So interesting things to watch in dynamics.
Yeah, it's funny that we've been talking about on the macro, there's been a lot of things that have kind of broken down some of those traditional relationships that we would have thought. I mean, Guy and Danny have been pounding the table on energy stocks in particular, but also crude. And you know, obviously some of the geopolitics is a bit confusing in all this. I'm just curious, where are you on commodities in general? Like that move in crude, you know, it was a couple months ago, it was in the low 70s. It got to the mid, almost the high 80s or so. And you could say that was a lot of geopolitics. Any of it there? Some of you mentioned some of those PMIs bottoming and stuff like that. I mean, I'll just use the word because Guy's not here, green shoots that you can, you know what I mean? As you look around the world.
We've been thinking since the start of the year that we would have somewhat of a cyclical recovery, which is typically supportive of commodities. I think the one thing that's missing from the commodity upside case at this point is China stimulus. Usually China M2 money supply growth leads commodities by 6 to 9 months on a year-over-year basis. And you're just not seeing that kind of stimulus out of China. So maybe you can make the argument that they don't matter as much as they did in prior cycles, but it'd be something that'd be nice to see to be more bullish. So I think you've seen the bottoming in the PMI. I don't know if it necessarily translates to a massive upcycle in earnings. earnings for cyclical kinds of companies. But I think the fact that you were down in the PMI for nearly 18 months and contraction territory, it's only natural that you would see an inventory cycle. I just don't know if it's enough to save the day on everything broadly. And the last point I'd say is it's already being forecasted to priced into GDP forecast. You went from having private investment be -1% last year to swinging to +2% this year. So there's some of that already contemplated.
All right. By the way, Cameron, you're not the only TV star on this set right now. Danny Moses, I think it was on Wednesday night, was up in Englewood Cliffs. That would be CNBC's
New Jersey
headquarters in New Jersey with the fabulous Contessa Brewer. And you were on there talking about gaming. Now, there's been a couple scandals of
gambling, to be specific.
Gambling in particular. Yeah. She is the axe in the gaming space. But
Correct.
You guys were talking about online gambling in particular. This week, Goldman, I think, put a $60 price target on DraftKings and made it like a top pick or something like that. And it's interesting, Danny. This is a story. Like, you know, when we think about 2021 and we think about all these crappy companies that went public via SPAC, okay, this is kind of like the only one
of them
that has really made it out of there. And this year might be a really interesting point where they get to gap profitability. So talk to us a little bit about the space, and I'd love to get your take on some of the scandals too.
Yeah, no, I'll start with the scandals because the stocks have all pulled in. Flutter, DraftKings, they've pulled in a solid 10%+ here the last few weeks, and a lot of it does have to do with these scandals. So Jontay Porter was, you know, found to have gambled on several games, including on his team, including betting against his team, including under bets on himself and three pointers made from 1.5.
I've never bet against you.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, he bet against his, I mean, talk about, now his salary is $417,000. So on the NBA side, I get it's not a lot. But let's go back to Tim Donaghy in 2007. He was the NBA referee that was fixing games.
But this is different.
It's different.
Right.
We know it's different. My point is that only since online gambling has been legalized can you actually track it and see it. This has been going on to some degree. So there's been plenty of scandals over the years. So now the question becomes for the leagues. Here's this interesting dynamic that's going on. The value of teams has gone up so much because of gambling. Why? Because of media rights. What are those related to? Eyeballs and gambling and so forth. Where's the next NBA expansion team supposed to go? Las Vegas. And so if you're a commissioner or owner, you know that gambling's here to stay. So these stocks have been hit on this, and I think it'll end up being a positive. I'm not going to comment on people being addicted to gambling like any other thing. That's terrible. I mean, there's no question of their marketing practices, but let's just keep it to the businesses itself. I think this is a buying opportunity on these names. I think it's going to highlight guardrails that need to be put up. And so I'm a buyer here into this weakness. I think it's a huge opportunity. And so we are just, again, the beginning of this evolution of gambling. And I will turn it back, you know, to you here, Cameron. As a source of tax revenue, give me sectors. States can tell these gambling companies, you're paying 30%. They're going to say, okay, because it's billions and billions of dollars coming in. So I think it's actually going to be counter-cyclical in a positive. So that's kind of my thought on those. So again, stocks have been hit. I'm a buyer on them, but I'd love to get your thoughts because cannabis and gambling and stuff like that, those are sectors or vices, but they're the source of growth for jobs and for tax revenue.
I think the stocks in general with these tend to, because of, you know, the 2021 kind of aura, tend to trade together. And I'm not close to the gambling stocks or the cannabis stocks.
Smart.
But I am looking at things like...
By the way, that's why your memory is so good.
Yeah.
Just to be clear. Keep going. Right.
Probably. I know nothing of sport. So that's my one blind spot. Okay. So if I ever get part of a
Trivial Pursuit, I'll tell you what, I'll do the sport thing and you can have all the other five subjects.
Okay. I'll take
Please.
History
can,
and, okay. and vocabulary,
you can take it all.
Obviously.
Okay. Right.
But, you know, I'm looking at the meme stock basket. I'm looking at ARK. And what's interesting, ARK has now reversed nearly all of its relative performance coming out of the October low, still well above its October low, but has broken down pretty materially.
ARKK we're talking about?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And all of these things, you know, we've seen as really functions of the liquidity trade and see them as a way to determine where liquidity is in the market. And if they're doing well, there's a liquidity boost to the market. If they're lagging, it's clearly a sign of liquidity coming out of the market. And you could see that very much in action through 2020, through 2022, and all of the performance. And so the thing I think with all of these things is that the thematics might be great and all of it, but you have to be aware of the macro liquidity backdrop and playing with all of these stocks just because they can move against you. And typically their correlations are really high to each other simply because they're being used as these baskets of liquidity sensitive types of things.
All right, last thing before we get out of here, earnings season. We've had, again, we've just talked about some of it. Maybe there's been 100 companies, maybe 20% or so. We're going to get to the bulk of some of these sectors we've talked about, industrials and tech, and these are probably going to be some of the biggest drivers. What are some things that are you generally optimistic heading into Q1 earnings season about what we're going to hear as it relates to guidance and the like? I'm sure a lot of folks, and we heard this with a lot of consumer companies, like a McDonald's, I think, and Starbucks, they had talked about just the Mideast unrest and the impact on sales. I expect, is that a mulligan for some of these companies? Strong dollar, higher rates, commodity prices, so input costs are going to be higher. Are we going to see some weakening margins that will cause some investors to just kind of look at our main man Butter's Q4 work and some of the stuff he's saying to kind of ratchet down this year a little bit? And then I get it. You said we're going to start really quickly as we get in the mid-year, really focused on 2025, but it seems like expectations are really high in the back half of this year.
And I think that the setup for this earnings season was just made that much more complicated because the stocks had run up so much. And so the bars were incredibly high. So if you come out and blame something like geopolitics and you're an apparel company, for example, that's not a great excuse. And mostly when you really do have to deliver, it gets you back to, you know, the reason we care about positioning, sentiment, and valuations is that tells you how high the bar is that the market has to jump over pretty much each earnings season. If those things are stretched, it's a very high bar. And I think that's what we're seeing today. I'm pulling up, you know, a name like Fastenal, which is one of the early industrial names that reported that's really broken down. Earnings weren't that bad, but the stock had run so much coming out of the October low that the bar was very high and it was due for a correction. But that correction is brutal because of the chase that you've had into those markets. So we're listening really closely. I think your point on the consumer is probably the most important. There's a lot of debate as to whether or not we can trust the macro data. Can we trust how strong employment data has been? Can we trust how strong retail sales data has been? And I think that the true results from companies will tell us, and the guidance from companies will tell us, how strong the underlying consumer is. And we get back to that performance of discretionary versus staples being something to watch, because that will be a great leading indicator for household consumption, which will lead GDP, which will then likely lead or spark a change in risk appetite. And so I think that listen very closely for what is being said about the consumer, and you know, maybe we'll follow up post-earnings season to see if there's any nuggets.
Well, Cameron, we're always smarter when you hear our listeners, and viewers are always smarter when we hear, and I'll say it one last time, the 2012 recipient of the Edward Moses Scholarship from Rollins College, well-deserved. He would be proud, and we're going to celebrate you today.
Well, happy birthday to the great professor.
All right. Thanks, Cameron. Thanks for being here. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week. Guy will be back.
In the seat.
Well, listen, you can keep it warm as long as you want, because, like, you know what I mean? But yeah. Thanks, Cameron.
Thank
we appreciate
you.
It.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, and FactSet.
If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com.
Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.